From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is off this week. I'm Bob Garfield.
For a long time now, there's been too much secrecy in this city. The old rules said that if there was a defensible argument for not disclosing something to the American people, then it should not be disclosed. That era is now over.
Barack Obama's very vocal denunciation of what watchdog groups called an obsession with secrecy during the Bush era was a common refrain into January of this year. Candidate Obama emphasized repeatedly that a President Obama would do better.
That was then, this is now. President Obama's Justice Department now not just defending Bush officials from lawsuits surrounding National Security Agency.
Even talking about this case in court, even with sensitive information excluded, would jeopardize national security.
Documents. I think once you start governing, it's very different than when you're running.
Or maybe not. First recognized by the Supreme Court in 1953, the state secrets privilege empowers the executive branch to effectively scuttle a lawsuit against the government on national security grounds, which President Bush did some two dozen times. Much to the dismay of civil libertarians who had hoped otherwise, the Obama administration has so far stayed the course, arguing that a number of cases involving the illegal wiretapping and rendition activities of the early 2000s should be dismissed. Under Obama, the Department of Justice has invoked the privilege three times in as many months, most recently last week in Jewell versus the NSA. In that case, five plaintiffs sued the National Security Agency and several Bush administration officials after their phone company, AT&T, provided information about their telephone calls. Mark Ambinder of The Atlantic magazine says the legal rationale has not changed with a change in administrations.
The Bush administration first and then subsequently the Obama administration claim that any trial in this case would require broad disclosure of the government's current very highly classified domestic surveillance activities. And it's extending that argument, saying that even previous programs that are no longer being used by the government to collect intelligence, the risk of disclosing them through a trial is simply too harmful to bear.
Now, sources and methods is a common refrain when the government is discussing its intelligence gathering. But there are ways beyond invoking the State Secret Act to protect sources and methods. Was there no intermediate step that the government could avail itself of to keep the NSA's activities secret?
It's a very interesting question because there certainly are things that the government could do. For example, they could run defense attorneys through a background check and clear them to see certain pieces of information, or they could ask for in-camera hearings with specially cleared federal judges and allow the judges to determine whether the information, if disclosed, would significantly harm national security. But what the government argues in this case is that some of these secrets are so grave that merely the potential that they might leak out in some form would jeopardize national security so severely. And in fact, the law and precedents are on their side because the judicial branch has given the federal government so much deference over the past 50 years to determine on its own what type of national security information is harmful. And essentially, the federal government can deem information harmful, and neither Congress nor the judicial branch has any recourse to say, no, 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 we disagree, that's not harmful enough.
Now, Obama has been deeply critical of the Bush administration's overuse of the privilege. So it seems surprising, at a minimum, that his own administration would be so quick to invoke it, you know, not once, not twice, but three times in its first 90 days in office. Any thoughts as to what's going on here?
I think there are a couple of cross pressures. Certainly, as a constitutional law professor, President Obama was familiar with the privilege itself. In fact, he did say that he supported the concept of the privilege. But during the campaign, he was critical of using the privilege not as a way to protect simply evidence from being introduced, but the Bush administration, he alleged, was using it willy-nilly to dismiss cases that might embarrass it. In the three instances we know of, because there may be other cases under seal where the privilege has been invoked, in the three instances so far, one of the more curious questions about the particular assertion of the privilege is that we already know a lot of the classified information that would seem to be at the heart of the cases. So when I've asked officials at the Justice Department and the White House why they found it necessary to continue to assert the privilege, they say, look, if we had to do it over, we might not have initially asserted these privileges in the first case, but the moment that we relax the assertion of a privilege on an already ongoing case, it will give, in a sense, a federal judge the ability to weaken the privilege altogether, which is not something that we as the executive branch want to do.
Presuming it is too early to judge the Obama administration's sincerity on its protests of openness and transparency, what can we look for in the near future to be reassured?
Well, there are going to be several bright line tests. One is the renewal of several controversial provisions of the Patriot Act, which are scheduled to sunset at the end of the year, including the use of so-called national security letters by the Justice Department to obtain data and information from individuals without a specific subpoena. I think, though, the larger test will be whether the president decides to support the State Secrets Privilege Act in Congress, the bipartisan bill that would essentially prevent the state secrets privilege from constituting the sole grounds for a dismissal of a case or a claim. And that would represent a significant, I guess you can call it a clawback, of congressional power at the expense of the executive branch. But it would certainly indicate that Obama's view of executive power is different than President Bush's.
Well, Mark, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Mark Ambinder is associate editor at The Atlantic and chief political consultant to CBS News. In the last 2 weeks, two states have legalized same-sex marriage. First, the Iowa Supreme Court ruled that a law banning same-sex marriage was unconstitutional. Then Vermont became the first state to legalize same-sex marriage through its legislature. When it comes to public opinion, supporters of gay marriage are still a minority, but they're a growing minority. A recent CBS poll showed that 33% of Americans support same-sex marriage today, up from 22% in 2004. Scott Barclay, a political scientist at New York's University at Albany, along with his colleagues, has been tracking that gradual shift in public opinion going back to 1990 and found a major contributing factor for the growing public acceptance is newspapers. The research found that public opinion on gay marriage followed the opinion of newspapers and not the other way around. And when they controlled for variables, Barclay says, they found newspapers' influence was more significant than any other factor, more influential than everything from religious groups to Will and Grace.
In the vast majority of the states we looked at, papers had a cumulative effect. They gently pushed readers over an extended period of time towards same-sex marriage.
So in some places, newspapers that editorialized on this issue were, you know, roughly within the jaws of consensus. Other times, they were going utterly against the tide of public opinion. Tell me about the Denver Post.
The Denver Post took an early position in support of civil unions, and they were unchanging in this position, despite the fact that there are clear indicators that the local audience for the Denver Post were hostile to same-sex marriage and civil unions for much of this period. The Denver Post actually, in an editorial, mocked their audience by saying, we've been here all along. You were sort of wrong in the past.
Now, we've had people on this program look at data and tell us that editorial endorsements, for instance, have very little effect on the outcome of elections. And then there's the question of gun control, which has been front and center on the editorial pages for decades with very little apparent effect. People still claim Second Amendment rights that the newspapers say do not exist. How do you know that the correlation between a shift in public opinion has anything whatsoever to do with the editorials of the community papers?
I think there was greater unity among many of the newspapers we saw, so they had a more unified position than they do on, say, gun control or on other issues or even on candidates. And I also think this was an issue that the newspapers thought of as something they could have an impact, that they thought of themselves as being important players in this area, much more than some of the other issues that were occurring.
Along about the end of President George W. Bush's first term, Karl Rove latched onto this wedge issue of gay marriage as evidence that the liberal elites were pushing America in a direction that America was loath to go. You know, looking at your research, it's hard not to conclude that he was right. Was he right?
I would say no. What our research indicates to us is that a large amount of Americans actually had either no really fixed opinion or had a very easily changed position. One of the things that's interesting for us is that even when states restrict same-sex marriage or there are constitutional amendments in a state, the more it was discussed, the more people had to think about it, the more they came to endorse this issue slowly over time. But still, they sort of moved on this issue.
Now, yes, 22% to 33%, according to the CBS poll, documents quite a shift in public opinion. But 33% is still only a third of the electorate. 2-1 against is a pretty dramatic ratio. Looking at these data, what would Sean Hannity say?
We think in 10 to 15 years, if the media activity continues, Sean Hannity will say what many other conservatives say about same-sex marriage, which is he would endorse it. And we think the reason we can take that position is because if we look back at interracial marriage, it was initially only at a 19% support level in 1968, 1 year after the Supreme Court, the US Supreme Court, had acted in this issue. When we combine support for civil unions and support for same-sex marriage, then in many parts of the country, we're approaching 60% of that region is actually in support of it. And so on a lot of these issues, it's not quite clear that 50% public opinion or above 50% public opinion is the key characteristic.
Scott, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Scott Barclay is professor of political science at the Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy at the University at Albany. Coming up, a brouhaha over an article on climate change and the arrest of an Iranian-American reporter has repercussions at OTM. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. A couple of weeks ago, the New York Times Magazine published a cover story on Freeman Dyson, an eminent physicist who has been in residency at Princeton University's Institute for Advanced Studies since the 1950s. The piece, titled The Global Warming Heretic, chronicles, among other things, Dyson's unorthodox opinions on climate change, namely his belief that scientists rely too much on computer-generated models and that carbon dioxide, which is contained in coal smoke, is not that bad for the environment. Of course, his thinking flies in the face of an overwhelming preponderance of scientific research. Dyson himself says that his views might be wrong and they're, quote, more a matter of judgment than knowledge. Some of the reaction to the article was severe, as bloggers and online commenters questioned the magazine's judgment, author Nicholas Davidoff's credentials, and Freeman Dyson's grip on reality. Among the most vitriolic was Joe Rome, a writer for the Climate Progress blog at the Center for American Progress, who ridiculed all involved and alleged that the attention devoted to Freeman Dyson was shameful.
If he were a Holocaust denier, or if he said cigarettes were good for you, then Davidoff would not be writing this favorable, extensive profile of his life and times.
You know, I got to say, back in the 70s, a guy named William Shockley, who had won the Nobel Prize in Physics for his work on developing the transistor, started coming out with some genuinely crackpot theories on race and was ridiculed and attacked. But the outrageousness of his theories did not make me less want to know what led to his using his Nobel laureate status as a bully pulpit for racist pseudoscientific views. I wanted to know more about him, not less. When people say controversial things, shouldn't we want to know more about them, not less?
Because of the way it covers global warming and similar issues, as he said, she said, the media guarantee that a certain fraction of the community is going to go out there and say outrageous things to be covered. I think that if there's a fire in a theater and you are screaming, there's no fire, don't move, then you don't deserve a cover profile in the New York Times Magazine.
Don't you give the audience any credit for a story that clearly characterizes Dyson's views as way beyond the scientific consensus? Do you credit them not at all for being able to parse the relative weight of these arguments?
The public is not scientifically expert. And the public's ability to distinguish science and pseudoscience, which sound pretty much the same, is very small. So it is up to the filters, the media, to use its own judgment based on talking to many different sources and itself weighing the credibility of sources. What the New York Times Magazine has done is elevate Dyson to a very high degree of credibility as a highly credible source on global warming, which he isn't.
Wow, I so can't believe we've read the same story. The story I read didn't promote his opinions in any fashion such as you're describing.
I disagree. Let me make two points. It states many of his positions at length and doesn't rebut each one of them. That, I think, is very important. Second, it is well known that most people, when they read things, they don't recall many months later rebuttals or how things were couched. There are a lot of people who read this who don't have an informed opinion, and they are going to read this, and they're going to think, oh, geez, there's a very smart guy out there who thinks global warming might well be good for us, and we don't need to do anything about it because we're going to invent genetically engineered carbon-eating trees. And I just think that it is this, you know, height of journalistic elitism to think that we're going to write a piece so clever that people will read between the lines to realize that we're secretly mocking him.
I don't suggest that he was mocking him either, but I think you're also ignoring the preponderance of the New York Times' reporting over the years, the extensive coverage that, for example, Andrew Revkin has given to this subject, you know, that I would say in no way sugarcoats the issue of climate change.
The New York Times does do some fine reporting on global warming, but the reader of this piece may or may not have read that. The media doesn't have unlimited space, and certainly not in high-profile places like a cover profile in the New York Times Magazine. And when they choose to write at length about a man like this, they are saying his ideas merit serious discussion.
I got to tell you, Joe, you know, this show has been right out in front of criticizing the way the media have covered global warming on precisely the false equivalency issues that we've discussed. But I just didn't see this story as having done that. It seems to me that you're not even angry about this story so much as you are about the press's whole history of covering this issue.
I hear what you're saying. As I say, I believe that the vast majority of the media and the public don't get how dire the situation is. I have talked to most of the leading climate scientists in the country. I read the literature closely. I also understand the nature of the energy system and how difficult it is going to be to reverse course and how much effort and time that takes. And this is worse than a needless distraction. This is just parceling out bad information with good information and hoping that the public is smart enough to distinguish the two.
Joe, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Joseph Rome is senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He writes about climate change for the center's blog, climateprogress.org. While Rome and others may be rightfully aggrieved by what they deem to be the legitimization of wild climate theories, their accusation that Nicholas Davidoff is a sports writer and therefore unfit to profile Freeman Dyson is plainly inaccurate. A Harvard graduate and Guggenheim fellow, Davidoff has written on such diverse topics as country music, the OSS, and Harvard economist Alexander Gershenkron, who was his grandfather. Davidoff himself rejects the argument made by Rome and others that a journalist who doesn't specialize in climate science should not write a piece that deals with it.
Many of America's finest journalists have been people who've been drawn to a diverse and really shimmering array of subjects. And just because they didn't have a particular expertise in one subject didn't mean that they couldn't acquire it. You must display expertise when you're writing about something for sure, but it doesn't mean that you have to have it going in. You have to have a certain ability. You have to be able to write. You have to be able to think, and you have to be able to know how to learn what is necessary to write whatever you're going to write about. And I mean, I killed myself for this Freeman Dyson piece, as I hope I do for every piece, but I spent months reading, talking to dozens and dozens and dozens of people, and it's true. I'm no authority on climate change, and he would never say that he was an authority on climate change.
Now, I can see how that charge might have stuck had you presumed to try to parse the various arguments and scientific explanations for global warming. But your piece actually scarcely discusses the issues at issue. This is very much a personality profile, is it not?
Yeah, it is. I mean, when I took on the assignment to write about Freeman Dyson, I wasn't writing about Freeman Dyson, the man who spent his life thinking about climate change. Freeman Dyson's life has involved an enormous array of fascinating, important subjects. And climate change happens to be something that he's been thinking about, which is very important to the American public right now. It's also a wonderful prism through which to look at an extremely subversive, complicated, brilliant, interesting person.
Now, it's not hard for me to understand why the reaction to your piece was so sharp. The green movement has, for years, had to suffer through journalism that discussed climate change on the one hand, and then through some sort of compulsive journalistic balance would give equal space to some reactionary dissent from the climate change deniers, which drove the scientific community and the political movement just nuts, because to them that was just false equivalency.
When people feel strongly about something, and when it's a matter of great urgency, and when it's a matter for many people of a looming apocalypse, of course it should be taken very seriously. But just because many people are scared and worried and feel that this is a time of impending doom if we don't do something, doesn't mean that you don't listen to somebody who disagrees with them. If there's somebody like Freeman Dyson, as eminent a scientist as Freeman Dyson is, who has provocative views on the subject, they're worth listening to. As you're going forward and making policy, you definitely always want to hear from people who are going to push back against consensus. It only makes the people who are the majority or the people who are going forward and making public policy sharpen their arguments. And while I can completely understand why some people would be dismayed that someone like Freeman Dyson doesn't agree with them, the fact is that, you know, I think it's healthy in a democracy when you're going forward with monumental legislation that you listen to everybody's point of view.
Does it matter from a journalistic point of view whether he's right or whether he's wrong?
Oh, absolutely not. I don't care what he thinks. I have no investment in what he thinks. I'm just interested in how he thinks and the depth and the singularity of his point of view. He's a completely original person and a brilliant and an unusual and an accomplished person and an unpredictable person, and that's what attracts me to him. I just think that he is so worth listening to whether you agree with him or not. And I certainly don't agree with everything that he says, but I'm interested in everything that he says. And there are not that many people in this world about whom you can say, I'm interested in everything that he says.
Nicholas, thank you.
Thank you. It's nice to talk to you.
Writer Nicholas Davidoff's article, The Civil Heretic, appeared in the New York Times Magazine last Sunday. His book, The Flyswatter, about the economist Alexander Gershenkron, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. And his new book, The Crowd Sounds Happy, which won an award from the National Alliance on Mental Illness, will be available in paperback in May. More than 2 months ago, Iranian-American reporter Roxana Saberi was arrested and detained in Iran.
A troubling situation is taking a grave turn in Iran, where an American journalist is now charged with spying.
Saberi grew up in North Dakota and had dual citizenship. She had lived in Iran for 6 years and has reported for NPR and the BBC.
Iranian officials have said that her journalist credentials had expired, but now they have added, quote, under the cover of a journalist, she gathered classified information and sent it to the U.S. intelligence services.
OTM producer Nazanin Rafsanjani has been following the story this week.
The words Evin prison strike fear in every Iranian. It's a place where journalists, political dissidents, scholars, and ordinary citizens have been held, tortured, and killed for years before and since the Islamic Republic came to power. It's located in the mountains of Tehran, and from down below you see the outlines of the prison walls, and you can't help but imagine what goes on in there. Roxana Saberi's parents traveled to Iran last week to visit their daughter in Evin. Before he left, Saberi's dad, Reza Saberi, spoke with NPR's Weekend Edition.
She hasn't had this kind of experience and this kind of hardship in her life. This is the first time, and we just don't know how long she can hold on.
She's been holding on now since late January. On February 10th, she called her dad to tell him she'd been arrested. I first heard about Saberi's arrest from my dad, who nervously called to ask if, in light of her imprisonment, Brooke and I were going ahead with plans to report in Iran this spring. Like Saberi, I hold dual citizenship, which means that when I'm in Iran, I'm considered an Iranian citizen, and the U.S. government can do little to help me if something goes wrong. We on the media had been discussing going to Tehran and reporting on the upcoming elections, the ever-shifting lines of press freedom, and whether the Obama administration's more conciliatory tone towards Iran had changed anything there. But that change in tone, some Iran scholars argue, is exactly what's made it so dangerous for Saberi and other journalists to be in Iran. Karim Sajjadpour is a Middle East analyst at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
There's absolutely no reason or pretext for the Islamic Republic to have imprisoned her, apart from the fact that there's factions in Iran who have a long history of wanting to sabotage any type of confidence building or détente between the United States and Iran.
It's happened before, says Sajjadpour. After September 11th, the U.S. and Iran had common goals. Both wanted to get rid of the Taliban and Saddam Hussein, Iran having fought an eight-year war against his regime in the 80s. The two countries actually were working together for the first time in a long time, until January of 2002, when Israeli forces intercepted an Iranian ship called the Karine A in the Red Sea. It was full of weapons and headed pretty overtly to Palestine. Karim Sajjadpour.
The Iranians really wanted to leave fingerprints. For two, three decades now, we've heard of Iranian military aid to groups like Hezbollah and Islamic Jihad, but we had never actually seen the physical results of it. They had never been caught. But this was a time when it seemed that they really did want to get caught. The thing we don't know is whom in the Iranian government we're talking about. Are these simply rogue elements within the regime, or are these actions mandated by the supreme leader himself?
Whoever was behind it, it worked. As Sajjadpour explains, that incident led to the now infamous labeling of Iran, North Korea, and Iraq in President Bush's 2002 State of the Union speech.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world.
After the U.S. referred to Iran as being part of the axis of evil, the Iranian leadership started to refer to the United States as the devil incarnate. And things really deteriorated since then.
The Obama administration has asked for Roxana Saberi's return, but it's also tried to make good on its campaign promise to extend a hand to Iran. Weeks after Saberi's arrest, on the occasion of the Iranian New Year, President Obama sent a message to the Iranian people and the government.
The United States wants the Islamic Republic of Iran to take its rightful place in the community of nations. You have that right, but it comes with real responsibilities.
Obama referred to Iran by its formal name, the Islamic Republic, something President Bush never did. It was a small but significant step. But with Saberi still behind bars, the question arises, why continue reaching out to a regime that jails an American for months without offering a shred of evidence to justify it, to her lawyer or anyone else? That's exactly what one reporter asked State Department spokesman Robert Wood during a press conference this week.
You seem to be reaching out a lot to Iran, but they don't seem to be responding in kind, particularly with the Saberi case.
Well, Sue, I think you're right. I mean, we have been reaching out to the Iranians, and we've said from the beginning of this administration that we want to engage in direct diplomacy with Iran. It obviously, we need a partner with an outstretched hand.
This back and forth between the two nations is a decades-long political game, now with a journalist caught in the middle. But for journalists, Iran has always been dangerous. There are few clear rules, so it's impossible to know if you're breaking them, until the clampdown, which comes suddenly, randomly, but inevitably.
There's an old adage from an Iranian intellectual who said that we have freedom of speech in Iran, but we don't have freedom after speech.
Karim Sajjadpour.
The problem in Iran is that there are certain red lines which everyone knows they should adhere to, which is no criticism of the supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei and no criticism of the Revolutionary Guards. But apart from that, Iran, by Middle Eastern standards, had a relatively open press. But especially since 2005, we've seen that the space for journalists and scholars and civil society activists has really narrowed, and these individuals are either being imprisoned or they're self-censoring.
That's what I did. I self-censored. When my dad called to ask if we were going to Iran, I know that the journalistically admirable thing to do would have been to say yes. Reporters take risks all the time, and I could have taken this one. But we decided not to go. If Saberi's arrest is in fact a way of resisting better relations with the U.S., it's too soon to tell if it'll succeed. But if it's a tactic to intimidate other journalists, it's working. For On the Media, I'm Nazanin Rafsanjani.
Coming up, advertising online is less and less a profitable proposition. But will people pay for the stuff they used to get for free? This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Centre at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. And now the latest on present and future business models for monetizing the newspaper industry.
Present and future business models for monetizing the newspaper industry.
The past couple of weeks have been very bad for those who believe that all content wants to be free. With a glut of online advertising inventory depressing not only online ad rates, but ad rates across all media, the titans who had long traded content for eyeballs were rethinking their calculus. News Corp CEO Rupert Murdoch said, quote, "People are used to reading everything on the net for free, and that's going to have to change." Jeff Bukas, CEO of Time Warner, unveiled a plan that would let people see cable programming free online, but only if they're cable subscribers in the first place. And the Associated Press, apparently disgusted with news sites like Google for selling ads adjacent to Google News, aggravated from the AP and others, said, no more free lunch. If you want AP content, you need permission and you need to pay for it. John Fine, media columnist for Businessweek, says this had something to do with the free fall of media revenue and something to do with negotiating tactics.
Google and the AP have a licensing agreement. Coincidentally enough, that licensing deal is up at the end of this year. And the thing that's starting to rankle the Associated Press and indeed newspapers and content providers broadly is that a lot of users are perfectly happy just to go to Google News, look at the headline and the first two sentences and decide they've basically had enough. They've gotten what they need out of it. That is not, bad word alert, monetized for the people who are making these stories.
Yeah, back in January, on this very show, the owner of Philadelphia Media Holdings, the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Daily News, complained that he wasn't able to monetize his web operation and said that papers have to start charging for content. 3 weeks later, his company was in Chapter 11 bankruptcy. And other voices have since come out to say, we have to charge, we have to charge, we have to charge. But just how? Is anyone doing that?
Some people are doing that. The Wall Street Journal is doing it. There are a couple of smaller examples elsewhere. There's a website, I believe, called Packers Insider. If you're an absolute diehard, screaming, insane fan of the Green Bay Packers, you pay $5 a month and get every data point you could possibly want on them. There's a newspaper in Little Rock called the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. Their site is primarily paid. The problem with that is that it's kind of hard to extrapolate that to the San Francisco Chronicle, the Boston Globe, you know, the local newspaper in Dubuque. I think that what we're going to see a lot of is all newspapers are going to try like sort of subsites that there's a paywall around. It's not like all of a sudden you won't be able to access anything on the Denver Post. It's rather that the Denver Post or, you know, the Salt Lake City Tribune are going to try to find little areas where they can, you know, get some money out of users. The problem is that it's kind of hard to see a way where that makes a heck of a lot of money. The newspaper in Little Rock is often pointed to as kind of a success here, but I think they maybe have, gosh, you know, 5,000, 10,000 paid users. That comes to a couple $100,000 a year. And if you are a big city newspaper, that's just not going to get you anywhere, especially when they're facing ad losses and indeed just losses, period.
The New York Times did try at one point to wall off some of its premium content with a program it called Times Select, charging people extra to see certain columnists and so forth. Finally abandoned Times Select because it was depressing online traffic and they needed online traffic to generate more advertising revenue.
I think the problem with Times Select was that it was kind of a half measure. Their political columnists and their foreign policy columnists aren't necessarily content areas where advertisers are dying to get next to them. Advertisers don't love hard political content, which is a problem that someone like Arianna Huffington's Huffington Post is going to run into. But they thought by doing it in a small way, it could work out for them. I'm not sure it was as enormous a failure as it was. I mean, they did get a substantial number of subscribers. They just decided they could get more the other way.
In the meantime, people like us have been trained that everything is for free. Can we be untrained to pay subscriptions for online content or, you know, some sort of micropayments to buy content a la carte?
The problem is free is very hard to beat. If you go to an awful lot of newspaper classified websites, you can click through. They're easily searchable. They look pretty decent. Whereas Craigslist, as we all know, it's just this kind of like online bazaar that's like, you know, the wall at your college where you used to tack up various garish flyers. But it's free.
It's a great price point.
And I think, you know, the danger is if, say, someone like the Minneapolis Star Tribune, another newspaper that's in bankruptcy, decides to put all of their site behind a paywall, well, there happens to be a local online news startup called, you know, minpost.com. They'd be ecstatic with that. And, you know, they have reporters and they're doing similar kinds of stories. And you're going to have that kind of free paid dichotomy. It's really tricky. If it was easy to figure out, someone would have figured it out by now. I mean, did these guys make a mistake in making it free at the very beginning? You know, maybe. Maybe. Can that genie be gotten back in the bottle? Maybe, but I wouldn't want to have to bet on it. The problem is there's not much else for these guys to bet on right now.
John, thank you so much.
Thanks, Bob.
John Fine is a contributor to CNBC and the media columnist for Business Week. Okay, that's settled. Ad support is a failed model. Pay-as-you-go may be the only path forward, except when it isn't. For instance, when it comes to music downloads in China. Whereas in the United States, people still occasionally pay for music tracks. More than 1 billion digital songs were sold last year, and iTunes is now the nation's biggest music retailer. In China, the piracy rate is 99%. So accustomed are the Chinese to free music that Google announced a deal last week in cooperation with the remaining four music companies and more than a dozen independent labels to offer 1 million-plus songs in China downloadable for free. The gimmick is that the site will be ad-supported, generating some revenue for the labels and presumably the artists. Greg Kot writes about music for the Chicago Tribune, and he's co-host of the public radio show Sound Opinions and joins us now. Greg, welcome to OTM.
Thank you, Bob.
So this new scheme is, as I understand it, that the songs are free, but Google gets ad revenue on its website and that it shares with the music labels. Is that how it works?
Yeah, that's exactly how it works. Google is basically attracting music from the major labels. It's paying the labels to license the music for them in order to attract advertisers, get eyeballs. And then as a result, they are going to take this revenue from the advertising and split it with the record companies, keep half itself, and figure out actually the first viable means, hopefully, of monetizing music in China on the internet.
You know, it's just kind of phenomenal, though. I'm thinking I get burglarized, right? They take my TV and my stereo and my jewelry. So I put on a deadbolt and they strike again. And this time they take my furniture and I install a burglar alarm and they come back again. And gone are the rugs and the paintings. So I decide to unlock all the doors and windows and just put up billboards for the burglars to see while they're stealing from me. Isn't that what they're up to?
You sound like the head of Warner Music or something. It's you know, they must be thinking, what do we have to do here? The people in China who have been stealing for years, basically, by the record company's definition, are rewarded for stealing by getting more free music. Whereas in the United States, the people who are actually paying for music on the internet, they are being rewarded by being sued if they download or share a music file without paying for it.
Very literally a double standard.
It is a double standard, and it makes me wonder, why hasn't this model been applied in the United States? It makes perfect sense. I mean, you mentioned the figure that, you know, more than a billion downloads had occurred in the last year. It's a record number of downloads, a record amount of revenues. But at the same time, for every legitimate download in the United States, there are 40 illegal ones. So there is no way they're going to catch up with the so-called pirates. The best thing that they can do is to apply this Google model. It seems like a worthy attempt anyway, to make it continue to feel like free, but figure out a way to make someone else pay for it. In this case, advertisers.
With online ad rates what they are, though, and they're low, it's hard for me to understand how the revenue generated by advertising to the music pirates could begin to approximate the kind of money that record labels would generate by selling the songs. Is this just that they're willing to accept a penny on the dollar just to get something out of their investment in this music?
Well, first of all, I think you have to understand is that the people making all the money off the sales of music in the last half century have been the record labels. The artists have not made a lot of money off the sale of music. That's a myth. There's a litany of artists who never got royalties. So you're essentially taking a zero-sum game anyway for these artists and saying something is better than nothing. The real losers in this whole new model that is coming into the music world are the record companies, the middlemen. They're the ones who have got to figure out how to insert themselves inside this scheme where they can make some money off it. The best they can hope for is to serve as a marketing arm for the artists.
Now, you spend a lot of your time talking to musicians who for years were stiffed by their labels, and now they're being stiffed by the market at large. And yet they continue to produce music and seek to get it recorded. Why do they keep smashing their heads against the walls? Why don't they just surrender and, go into dentistry?
I say these people are, with all due affection, these people are crazy, just like writers are crazy. You know, you don't do it because it's a way to make money. You do it because you have to do it. There's no other thing you can possibly imagine yourself doing. That will never go away. Similarly, the desire for people to gather in groups to see music, to witness music, to hear it performed will never go away. That's why all these demise of the record industry, music industry stories are so, at the end of the day, meaningless to me, because artists can get more music out to more people in quicker fashion than ever before. And if I'm an artist, I'm somebody making music, I'm thinking I'm stepping into a world full of possibility. It's really more an issue of the 20th century music industry that is gnashing its teeth and wringing its hands and wondering, woe is me. The artists and the fans are going to be just fine.
Greg, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Greg Kot is the host of the public radio show Sound Opinions and author of the upcoming Ripped, How the Wired Generation Revolutionized Music. Two weeks ago, Microsoft announced the death of Encarta, its encyclopedia software. The company will discontinue the program's website by the end of October this year and stop selling the software altogether by midsummer, except in Japan, where it'll be sold until the end of 2009. For many, the only thing surprising about the news was that Encarta even still exists. Most computer users use the free crowdsourced Wikipedia. But that wasn't always the case. Launched in 1993, Encarta was the go-to research tool for a generation of students. Then Microsoft CEO Bill Gates and current CEO Steve Ballmer knew the software would be popular, but primarily viewed Encarta as a chance to highlight the usefulness of personal computers. To their happy surprise, the software trounced its print competitors, quickly outselling Warren Buffett's World Book Encyclopedia and the famed Encyclopedia Britannica. Tom Cordry worked on the team that helped design Encarta. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So there's this story, apocryphal or not, I do not know, but it's before the launch of Encarta, and Bill Gates approaches his friend and business associate, Warren Buffett, who owns the World Book Encyclopedia, tries to buy it from him. Buffett says no and supposedly says what?
Warren's reported remark was, "I resent the implication that World Book doesn't understand technology. How do you think we make plastic smell like leather?"
Now, what puzzles me about the story, though, I mean, if true, is that I understand why Microsoft did Encarta. What I don't understand is why World Book and the Encyclopedia Britannica didn't get to that market way ahead of you.
That was our first thought. You know, I mean, that's why we approached them. We assumed that they would do it. The reason they didn't, the World Book had five divisions. One of those five made the book. The other four were sales organizations. The president of the real bookmaking part, a guy named Peter Molman, joined our group pretty early on. And he explained it. He said, you know, here's how the sales pyramid scheme works. Here's how many people are employed selling encyclopedias. Encyclopedias aren't bought, they're sold. You can't take them to a bookstore. Somebody has to go door to door. They have like full-size photographs of what the encyclopedia will look like on your bookshelf on foam core. And they bring that into your house and find a bookshelf and put it in there. And, you know, you can see how much better a parent you'll be if that's there. And I remember this was when the light bulb went on for Steve Ballmer, who was a total skeptic about all things web and multimedia in those days, but he got it about Encarta, that the great parental guilt purchase of the first three quarters of the 20th century was encyclopedias. And that's where the market was. I mean, in Britain, by, say, the 1980s, the biggest buyers of encyclopedias were first-generation Pakistani families. I mean, that was true everywhere in the world. But that shifted. In the 80s and early 90s, those families started thinking, boy, if I'm going to do one thing for my kids that's going to make the most difference, I'm going to buy them a computer. So we said we can combine the two great guilt purchases into one.
I got to tell you, in preparing for this conversation, I ran across some really fascinating encyclopedia production arcana. For example, when editing the print encyclopedias, every word that was added had to be compensated for by a word that was cut out, every paragraph for a paragraph. And for production efficiency, that stuff tended to come from adjacent articles. What would happen, for example, if you wanted to change your entry on Bosnia?
Or in this case, you had to write one because nobody had much of an article on Bosnia until, you know, it happened. So you start looking right next to Bosnia, you know, what can we cut out of Boss Tweed, or, you know, what can we cut out of Boston, or what can we cut out of Bozo the Clown, or, you know, whatever. So the editorial effort, I mean, they were spending money on smart editors to do that. It wasn't creating any more value for the person using the encyclopedia. It was just being used to keep the page count the same because they couldn't make the books fatter and fatter, and they didn't want to touch many more pages than they had to because of all the pre-press cost.
In the same way that your CD-ROM business model gave you more flexibility than your technological predecessors, Wikipedia was able to clean your clock. When did it become apparent to you that Encarta's days were numbered?
Before we launched it. We used to have conversations internally that CD-ROM was some kind of a transitional medium for what we were doing and that there would be something online. This is before the web. But we talked about it, you know, well, what will we do when that happens? Do we have sort of a limited lifespan business model, or will we find a way to take it there? We thought we'd probably find a way. It wasn't a surprise, I don't think, that when the web came along that it made something like Encarta hard to sell for money. You know, I'm a huge admirer of Wikipedia, and I'm fascinated by it, and I use it every day. But I don't think it's, quote-unquote, killing Encarta. What really has killed Encarta is the web itself.
Tell me more.
You know, if you think about what you do when you want to find out something, 9 times out of 10, people just, you know, Google it. And Wikipedia's brilliance is that it almost always comes up on the first page. But if there's no Wikipedia article, there's still Google.
So, goodbye, for the most part, Encarta. Hello, Wikipedia. But if every dog has its day, when do you suppose Wikipedia will face its own doom?
Oh, I'm so tempted to issue an exact date and time, but I think Wikipedia... Sorry.
Yes, Bob, I've just computed that. It will be September 14th, And it'll be about 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah, right, on the East Coast.
Anyway, well, listen, thanks an awful lot. I very much appreciate your spending the time.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Tom Cordry is CEO of Einstrong LLC and former general manager of Microsoft's Multimedia Publishing Group. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, with help from Cara Gianfrido. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink. Drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.